And you are here for Jen Fry. Welcome to the Implicit Bias Within Athletics, Understanding Our Personal Bias and Practical Steps for Reducing Bias in the Workplace.
Jen?
Thank you. I told her to give me like an uber short intro. Y'all are like, that's it? Yes, that's it. Let me get you all to come down. I like to call our coaches in because one main thing we have to remember is that we have to role model. And the things that we want our athletes to do, if we're awesome role models, they'll do it. So I'm going to ask you guys all like to come here because you guys are going to talk to each other. Like if you thought I was going to talk for an hour, you are dead wrong. So just come down. Be next to somebody. I want you to sit next to someone you don't know. Because it's like look at someone and be like, I don't know you. We're going to chat. You're going to make some new friends here. Sit down. Take a seat. We're going to chit-chat. Bring all your junk. Okay, perfect. So I am Jen Fry. So the first thing I want to do is say thank you for coming. There's so many sessions, and you chose to come and listen to me. So thank you. So I'm Jen Fry. I run Jen Fry Talks. Jen Fry Talks is a social justice firm that focuses on educating and empowering those within athletics through an anti-racist lens. We don't talk about not being a racist. Like, that doesn't happen. We talk about how to do anti-racist work. It's really, really different. So I was a college volleyball coach for 15 years. I coached at Elon. I coached at Illinois when we played for the national championship in 2011. No one's here from UCLA. Great. I'm still bitter. We lost. Just going to throw that out there. 9 years later. I decided to literally quit coaching. 2 weeks before season ended, I said, I'm gone. I wanted to work in diversity and inclusion. So I traveled the world, got a job at Duke for 3 years, and then decided to quit again and pursue my PhD full time. And so I'm doing my PhD in geography. Most people are like, geography? So I want to study the racial experiences of professional black volleyball players overseas and kind of do a comparative analysis of what are their experiences when they go to Asia, when they go to Latin America, what are these experiences like, and tell everybody because we're sending our players there. And we have to have a better understanding of the situations that our black athletes could be potentially going into. I know some of my experiences from traveling the world and how they were, and sometimes you feel like you're the only person. So that's what I'm going to be doing my research on. Objectives. We're coaches. We got to have a game plan. So we're going to go over that. So the first thing is we're going to develop a shared language here. One thing we have to remember is that when we invite new athletes into our team, we have a shared language, right? Our offense is called Blue Pickle. You might came from offense that was named Red Unicorn. That's fine, but we're going to talk about the Blue Pickle. So it really is important because if you don't have a shared language, you guys don't know what you're talking about. And that's really important when we're talking about implicit bias, race, racism, those type of things, that we have a shared language. The next thing is we're going to understand the universal development of implicit bias. Those are kind of big key words right now, so we're going to kind of dig more into it about how did implicit bias on a universal aspect become developed. The next thing is we're going to critically think about identity in relation to biases. Many times people talk about biases, but they don't talk about them in relation to our identities. We're going to get really personal. It's going to get really awkward and uncomfortable. This is going to be the best time ever. So understand that and just kind of enjoy it. Because we always tell our athletes, right, you're going to be uncomfortable. You're going to grow. Well, I want you as coaches to think the same thing. And then the next thing is I'm going to give you practical steps on reducing bias in the workplace. Because if we've learned about our identity, then we understand more about what we're doing that might affect bias. Does everyone understand that stuff? Are we good? Okay. So we're going to have some ground rules. And it's really important that we have ground rules. When we have team conversations, things can get really hot and spicy. How many of y'all have been in a conversation in a team that it got hot and spicy? Raise your hand. And everyone's like, okay, what do we do now? Right? So we need to have ground rules. So I want you to think as coaches of, do we always have these ground rules for all our team meetings? Always. It might be a great meeting. It might get really difficult. But do we have ground rules so that we have this standard of how we will treat each other in these conversations? Because that's the most important thing is how are y'all going to treat each other? Because when you leave this office, y'all are going to have to go play with each other, right? And we have to think about that. How can we make sure that we have ground rules? So the first thing is focus on the idea, not the person. You will be sharing some personal stuff. It's going to just be dependent on you of how personal you want to get. But we want to make sure that we're focusing on the idea of what they're saying and not be like, yo, you're an idiot. It's really easy, and I understand that. but we want to make sure we're focusing on that idea. Talk about the idea. The next thing is privacy. This is something that you need to, I don't want to say beat into your kids, but you want to kind of really push the boundaries with this and say, we have got to have a private team. Nothing's going to be confidential, not in this world, but we want to make sure privacy is one of the biggest things that we just focus on, because we are not going to blow people up on the internet. We're not going to leave that someone just talked about their brother being in prison and you're leaving going LOL, you know, LOLing a joke on Twitter. Like, we're not doing that. Because if people can be vulnerable, that's going to create an amazing culture. But you have to really dig in about privacy. And that's what I'm digging about you as well, is we're going to be private. Because this is one of the only times that y'all as coaches can learn. Because you have to take this and immediately, when you go to the team, you're the person that knows it all. So this is the time right now that you learn how to kind of think about maybe your own biases and things you've grown up with. We're going to talk about some difficult things here. You know, you might say, oh my Lord, I grew up in an all-white household, in an all-white school, all-white town. My parents told me, you have to love everyone the same, but we never had a person of color ever walk through our door. Think about how that's like, ooh, that's tough to start thinking about. And so understand we've got to be private. The next thing is you have to be willing to be uncomfortable. As coaches, oh, y'all don't have to worry about writing it down. If you want, I can send you some stuff. I have my business card and my face on a picture. You take it? So I can give you all this. So be willing to be uncomfortable. You are always going to role model what's right and wrong with your team. Always. So if during a workshop that the athletic department is saying that you have to have, and you're up there on your phone, your team is going to do that. So if you're like, I have been really pulling myself apart and being uncomfortable, your team is going to do that same stuff. So I really want you now to just think about being uncomfortable and be like, whoo, child, I'm going to be uncomfortable, and I'm going to be okay with that. So right now, you have 20 seconds. I want you to think in your mind or write down, these are two things that I do when I get uncomfortable. Just write them down. Be like, you know, do you twirl your hair, look at your phone, bite your nails? Think of it. Like, when I get uncomfortable, what do? I know I start to talk really, really fast and make some really bad jokes. And those are my two things when I get uncomfortable. And I want to be able to say, okay, I'm getting uncomfortable. How can I kind of work through it? So you have 5 more seconds. What do you do when you get uncomfortable? Write down 2 things. Because think about this. If you're telling your players to have these conversations and immediately you can say, this is what I do when I get uncomfortable, it's opening the door for them. The next thing is oops and ouch. And I want you to really think about how you can implement this. So oops is like, say you're talking to an athlete and you realize, holy crap, I'm starting to say some really problematic things. Just say, can I rephrase that? Oops. That wasn't what I wanted to say. Let me rephrase that. Because that takes vulnerability, right? To say, I'm screwing up. And I admit that. And the next thing is ouch. If you're talking to someone and you're like, okay, this is not sounding right. Ouch. Can we move on? So I'll tell you, I did that once. So I was getting my concealed carry permit. And it's like in North Carolina, the gun range I had to go was like, I don't know, like 20 miles into the deep forest in this guy's house. I know what y'all thinking. And so I'm getting my concealed permit, you know, and so there's guns everywhere. And he starts talking about like the Trayvon Martin murder. And I'm like, ouch, we're not doing that. We are moving on. And he got really mad and wanted to kick me out. But I was like, we're not doing that. So being strong and vulnerable, you'd be like, ouch, nope, we're not talking about that. Or that way, or those words. Okay? So thinking about that. The next thing is to challenge yourself and get curious about your reactions. As coaches, we're not taught to do this. We react, and that's it. Versus, why are these my reactions? Why do I, when an athlete says something, do I want to cross my arms or get pissed or whatever it is? Like, think about that. Or not talk about it. Because your reaction says a lot about the ability for your athletes to come and talk to you. And then really listen with the raw openness today. People are going to be going through some stuff. They're going to be figuring shit out. Like, y'all got to start helping people work through it just like you are. So be open, be vulnerable. You know, like, kind of listen to stuff and be like, I'm okay with, I've got more information of changing how I view things. Be okay with that. For some reason, people don't want to. Be okay with being like, you know, I learned some stuff. My opinion's changing. You know, before I was dead set against playing athletes, and then I went to a school where we had an athlete that had a Zion cam. I kind of changed my opinion a little bit. So I'm okay with saying that because I've got some more information. And then be present. It's easy to be on our phones. I know y'all got like 8,000 emails probably just ringing the whole time. I understand that. But let's be present and really learn from each other, build some cool relationships and kind of learn and grow so that when you leave here, you're like, okay, I've got some good kind of foundational skills now so that I can talk about these things with my teams. So we're going to talk about a brave space. We don't have a safe space here. When people of color and white people are interacting, there can never be a safe space. It's not safe for people of color. But it can be brave. And what brave space means is that we have the need for courage rather than the illusion of safety. So I want you to be super courageous. Super courageous in what you're talking about, what you're working through. You know, saying like, hey, what you talked about, my family did the same thing. After this, can we go grab some coffee? Be really, really courageous. The next thing is own your intent versus impact. Many times, people will say something really problematic and be like, that wasn't my intent. Your intent doesn't matter. If I was driving and hit you, would you be like, okay, if I was like, hey, that wasn't my intent to break your arm? Probably not, right? So the same thing is that, own it. Be like, I'm sorry for my impact. What can I do better? Intent does not matter. It's what is your impact? How does it land? Who does it hurt? And then ask yourself, do you create a brave space for your student athletes? So many times, I'll hear coaches say, well, I tell my athletes to come and talk about whatever. But do you create brave space? Or when they do come and say something that challenges you, do you get pissed off? Well, that wasn't what I was talking about. You're being sensitive. Or do you say, I apologize, let's work through that. So really ask yourself, can people come and talk to you about really tough things and have a good conversation? Because your athletes of color, especially if you're on a predominantly white institution, have probably gone through a lot of stuff that you have no clue about. And if your only thought is to say, well, they didn't tell me so nothing's happening, then you don't create a brave space. I'll tell you that right now. So ask yourself, do you create a brave space for your student athletes? Okay, so we're about to get into it, y'all. I need you to turn to the person next to you and give them like a big high five. Big. Be athletic here. Don't give no bad high fives up in this room. We're not doing that. Okay, so the first thing we're going to hit is language. Like I said, we're talking about the blue pickle. We're going to talk about that right now. So we're going to talk about language. So with race, have two people, what's your definition of race? Be brave. Yes.
Social construct, differences between skin color.
Okay, what else? Move one more person. Okay, nationally, where are you from? Thank you. Okay, so for our purposes of this, race is a social construct. Okay, just like what the gentleman was saying, really it's just about classification. It was made to have one group above another one based on hair, skin color, bones. That's all it is really a social construct. So when people talk about this thing that is race that is so potent, it really is just something made up. There is a great podcast called Paul Save the People. And DeRay McKesson, you know, he said, people always say, well, why do you always make it about race? And the question should be, why did race always make it about us? We didn't make it about race. Race made it about us. So we have to think on a deeper level of what we mean by race, because even though it's something completely fake, it is destroying lives. And so we have to look at race in a totally different way of something that was made up. So when we talk about racism, let me get some definitions. Two people, what are your definitions for racism?
Not tolerating another race.
Okay, not tolerating another race. Thank you. Let me have one more person. Yeah.
Like discrimination on something based on the
social construct. Okay, perfect. Thank you. So what it is, it's a system. It's not a person. It is a system. It is a system in which one race maintains supremacy over another through attitudes, behaviors, social structures, and more importantly, institutional power. The problem is we look at it as a person. So if we look at it as a person, if that's that person, I can say, well, I didn't do that. That's not me. I'm not racist. I'm not racist. I'm not that person. Versus it's a system that will continue forever if we threw all the racist people on Mars. We have to look at this as a system. When I lived in North Carolina, little fun fact about me, I had 9 hate groups within 2 hours. I had a KKK rally after the election. I had another one a month after I left. So I am used to those people. But we have to think of it as a system. Because if we change how we think of it, then we can start changing policies and procedures. And then we can understand how we've been super problematic in allowing those things to continue. So if we look at attitudes, it's the attitude of hair like mine. It seemed unprofessional. This could cost me a job. Literally, I could not get hired because I have an afro. It's really important that we think about that. Because we have to think about when we're hiring, what are our expectations of the people who come and interview? What do we expect about their hair, what they wear? I stopped wearing two-piece suits a few years ago because, A, they suck because they have that silk lining. Y'all know what I'm talking about? That always rubs you. Not doing that. But I said, I'm going to have this, and I'm going to show my whole tattoo. And so these attitudes cannot get me a job. If we think about when we're on hiring committees, names. Learn people's names. I don't care if they're hard for you. Learn people's names. So many times, well, what's your name? Oh, I can't say. I'll just call you T. Don't be that person. Learn people's names. Because what you're telling someone is that their name is not important enough for you to learn. And that's some serious stuff. Like, your name is just too difficult for me. No, say, you know, I'm going to keep trying because I want to make sure I'm learning your name appropriately. What do you want to be called? So it's really important because those things, those attitudes, those behaviors will now teach your athletes what to do in hiring. Because, right, we're training the next level of leader, the next generation of leaders. So if we're teaching them not to learn people's names, what does that mean when they're hiring and they see a resume and they're like, oh, that name's too tough. I'm not going to do it. So we need to make sure we are learning people's names. Social structures. You know, we have to look at housing. If you are bringing in athletes of color to predominantly white schools, are you helping them if they have to find a roommate? I will tell you, I'm in Michigan State for my PhD. I was looking for a roommate. I have to be like, I am a black female to protect me. So are you telling your black athlete, oh, just go and just ask anyone to room. Don't do that. Because you can be putting them in an unsafe space. And you didn't even realize that. So it's about all these different structures. Who has the power? Who's not giving it up? And what are the policies and procedures that they're making that are affecting people? So the next thing is whiteness. Let me have two people. What do you think your definitions of whiteness are?
Like having a lighter complexion that therefore gives you privilege and allows you to pass through life and society.
Okay. Okay, thank you. And then?
The default state of being in a privileged culture.
Okay, perfect. So how many of you have been in diversity workshops? Raise your hand. Okay. How many of you talked about whiteness in them? That's pretty tough though, right? If you're in these and you don't even talk about something that maybe affects how you navigate the world and you haven't even known that. So when we talk about whiteness, is my thing on? Let me see here. Oh, this internet. Let me do this. So it's the academic term used to capture the all-encompassing dimensions of white privilege, dominance, and assumed superiority in society. These dimensions include ideological, institutional, social, cultural, historical, political, and interpersonal. Who's writing the history books? How many of y'all have heard of redlining? Raise your hand. Okay, let me have someone. Boo, what's redlining?
Redlining is the districting or the sectioning off of the city to create certain neighborhoods or areas to benefit the tax or election rates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So redlining was made in the 1930s, and essentially it was made to say this is a good area to live, this is a bad area. And if you look at maps, so I would suggest where you're from is to just Google redlining and your city. And you'll be painfully surprised at what you haven't been taught about where you live. And literally it's putting, in 1930s, the government put sections around areas and said, the red area, this is bad. And what that meant, that the people who lived there did not get loans. Houses, I mean, the appreciation just was destroyed. We didn't have any restaurants, no grocery stores, nothing. Then you had yellow. And yellow was where a lot of white people lived and some people of color. And then you would see loan people or real estate agents come in and say, hey, this is going to be a bad area. You might want to leave. So they'd move and then that area become red. And the green area was the main area to live in. And people of color didn't live there. So when we look at how segregated neighborhoods are, there's a reason they're that way. And we don't realize that there's a reason. Oh, this neighborhood's always been like that. If people of color wanted to live there, they totally could have. No, they couldn't have. And so in Charlotte, in the Mecklenburg area, they, in some of the suburbs, they actually had, used to have racial covenants that black people could not live there. And so there was this thing that they wanted to do, was they said, we are not, that's not us anymore. We want to completely take out those racial covenants. But guess what that means? That pretends that that never happened. And that this neighborhood is the way it is just because of the way it is. And people are like, nah, buddy. Just cross them out, but we have to know that they were still there. And so those are things that aren't taught to us. That that things are the way they are just because that's happenstance. And nothing is happenstance. And so when we look at history, how is history told to us? Are we told about redlining? Are we told about the Social Security Act of 1935, in which agricultural and domestic workers were not given access to Social Security, retirement, unions? So my parents had to keep working. Your parents could retire. What does that mean for the wealth gap? Are we taught that? So thinking about whiteness in a more academic term, what happens a lot of times is when we talk about whiteness, people get super uncomfortable. And that's understandable because you've never had to learn about it. I understand that. But if we start learning about this more, this is going to help our implicit biases. So we have to think on a different level. So now we're going to talk about anti-racism. And this is just the active process that I want you to start thinking about. It's the active process of identifying and eliminating racism, changing systems, procedures, policies, so that power is redistributed equitably. It's about being in a media and saying, why is this table of white people? Why do we have no LGBT? Why do we have no people of color? We need to bring them in. It's about being anti-racist. It's not about not being a racist. Because that doesn't even exist anymore. We have to think in a different way. If we think of racism as a moving escalator at the airport that you're standing on, if you're making overt racist policies, you are like sprinting on that bad boy. But if you're the person that's like, well, that's not my business. They didn't mean that. That's really not racist. I'm just going to be quiet. You're on that moving escalator, but what are you doing? You're still moving with racism. You can say that's not me, but if you're not actively pushing back, you're still doing the same thing that the people sprinting are. Your silence is taken as you being complicit. So we want to make sure that we're not doing that. We want you to be actively running against that moving walkway, changing systems, saying that is going to be me. I'm going to be changing systems. Because if I'm about diversity and inclusion, I can't just bring in black faces. I have to make it a safe space for them. It's really important. And so now our socialization. Okay, this refers to the systemic training and to the norms of our culture. It's the process of how we learn, how we practice stuff. It's really all about how we look at the world. So how many of y'all are Prince fans? Raise your hand. I'm a huge Prince fan. If no one raised your hand, I would have been like, we're done. Leave. So think about Prince. He would wear a purple velvet onesie, right? Halter top with high heels, and everyone would be like, that's just Prince. He cool. But then all of a sudden, guys a few years ago wanted to wear the one-piece things, and people were like, why would you wear that? I'm like, it's a one-piece of clothing. Who cares? Because girls, isn't the worst thing you're in the bathroom and you take off your whole outfit? Guys, if you want to join us with that, you're more than welcome. Like, be at the urinal with your whole outfit at your knees. I don't care. Welcome to the club. But what in our culture determined that one piece of clothing is bad? Like, who determined that? Who determined that my hair is unprofessional, but straight hair is professional? That to go to an interview, the people being interviewed have to have their best suit on, and the people doing the interview could wear whatever. How many of y'all been in an interview interviewing someone in, like, a t-shirt and running shorts? Raise your hand. Y'all just, like, I've worn stuff. I wear my Happy Friday shirt and jeans. But why does the person interviewing, because we're interviewing each other, why does that person have to be in a suit? Because if they came in a Happy Friday shirt, what would you guys say? What are they wearing? They're at an interview. How dare they? So we have to think about, like, our socialization and who's determining what's okay. I was listening to this athletic director podcast, and this one AD, I was like, I'm about to hurt you. He was like, you know, I talk to all these women. I tell them, you know, when they're preparing for interviews, don't wear bright nail polish. And I was like, that? Like, you can't wear pink nail polish? But who determines that stuff? And so intersectionality. This is the understanding that we simultaneously occupy multiple social positions, okay? These positions do not cancel each other out. They're always going to interact in very complex ways. I will never be just black, and I will never just be a woman. I will always be a black woman. I will never be an Asian guy or Asian and male. You'll always be Asian male. So we always are going to have those identities. So you have to think about that when hiring. If you have a team that you're getting a lot of people of color, you can't say, well, I have, you know, three assistant coaches if they're all white women. You have to think about intersectionality. How are these identities intersecting and affecting experiences? Because it's really important that we think about that on a very different and complex way. And then implicit bias. And so with this one, this is what we're here to talk about. And so when we talk about implicit bias, it's going to refer to the attitudes or stereotypes that affect our understanding, actions, and decisions in a very unconscious manner. So that's what we have to think about. This is the stuff that we don't realize that we have been socialized to do all the time in a very unconscious manner. It causes us to have feelings and attitude based on characteristics such as race, ethnicity, age, or appearance. I don't wear hoodies when I go to the store. It makes me really uncomfortable because I wonder what people's implicit biases are of me if I'm wearing a hoodie. If I'm walking around, are they like, oh, that's that PhD student, she's fine. Or is it, oh, that's that black girl? So I have to think about these type of things. It's really important that we start thinking about, you know, our feelings and attitudes and what implicit biases might we have that we've never even realized. And these associations develop over the course of a lifetime, beginning at a very young age, and both with direct and indirect messages. And lastly, the media news programs are very often cited origins of implicit associations. There was a Muslim man, I think an actor, he said, I will never play a terrorist again. He said, they keep asking me, he's like, I will never play a terrorist. Because think about it, if you see terrorists in only a certain way, what are you going to have your implicit biases about? Who's going to be a terrorist and who's not? Okay, so here's a few characteristics. They're pervasive. So many people when I talk, especially coaches, are like, I don't have any biases. I love everyone the same. And I'm like, man, you don't even love all your kids the same. Quit playing. Like, how are you going to love your athletes the same? So think about that. They're pervasive. We all have them. And the faster we understand it, the faster we can work on them. Okay? Implicit biases are related, but distinct mental constructs. These are things that, you know, you'll say, I'm liberal, I believe everyone's the same, but then you see a black guy walk in, you unknowingly, clutch your purse or lock your doors. Okay? They, like I said, do not necessarily align with our declared beliefs. We might say these things, but then situations think these things and don't even realize it. Okay? And we generally tend to hold implicit biases that favor our own in-group. Through research that has shown that we can still hold implicit biases against our in-group. So we can do both ones, and that's what we see with a lot of people of color. You know, we'll hold those biases, and then, I mean, we could, if anyone wants to talk to me afterwards, we can talk about, like, colorism, and then the spectrum of light skin to dark skin, and what that means also is with implicit biases of who we've been taught to believe is dangerous. There's data that shows, you know, black people that are darker skinned are deemed more dangerous than lighter skinned people. So that is also within different subgroups. So now you're going to parent share, you're going to meet a new friend. So everyone's like, oh crap, Jen, you got to talk to each other. Okay, so I want you to think about those definitions and think about how have you learned your definitions? Because I would say probably other than maybe whiteness you didn't think about, you had definitions to all this. You just didn't realize it. So how did you learn those definitions? How have your definitions shaped you? If you always had kind of this subconscious definition of X, how has it shaped how you think about things that you've seen in the media or situations that have happened on your team? Because let me tell you, I get a lot of 911 calls from schools. Racial stuff is happening everywhere. So think about these, how these definitions shaped you, and then what's going on with your team that maybe is race-related. And then what do definitions tell you about your upbringing? Because people, your family's teaching you stuff. So what do these definitions tell you about your upbringing? So I want you to find a new friend, introduce yourself, and then you're going to have about 5 to 7 minutes to talk about this. Action, go. Y'all got to get up, athletes, look, my volleyball players, y'all going to have to get up and talk to somebody new. Okay, give a high five and say thanks for sharing. Okay, let me have 3 people kind of share out what you chatted about. Any of those questions, let me move on back. Any of these, okay? Just tell me, what did you share out? What did you learn? What did you think about yourself? Like, anyone critically analyzed, be like, oh, crap, I never thought about this stuff. Yes?
Like, her and I kind of said, we noticed we didn't really have those definitions. Mm-hmm. And that kind of shows that it was never anything we... It was, like, that privilege that mm-hmm. we just never even thought about it, almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you. Another person, I saw someone raise their hand.
Mm-hmm. Whether it's being with someone in the past or having people in your community or your church that are kind of looked at differently, and you have to experience what other people say and how you want to have a different relationship with them and welcome them.
Mm-hmm. Awesome, thank you. One more person. Darren.
I think we just talked about in more of a literal sense that, you know, you go to, you're in elementary school, middle school, and you're in history class, and you open up the book, and the words right there and the definitions right there, and you know, write them down and memorize the definition in that sense. So that's kind of how, what we talked about, how we learned about that.
Yeah, and I think it's really important we think about that. Because if we can't really change our biases if we're not critically thinking about ourselves and something like definitions. And ask your athletes, you know, when they're in classes, like, have you looked at the syllabus? Are they all white authors that you're reading? That's probably going to be a problem. Maybe talk about that. Because if you show that growth, your athletes will follow behind you. But it's really important that we learn these definitions so that we have a foundation when stuff happens. We can say, okay, we've learned this definition because it's, you know, something they talk about in articles. It includes power and privilege. Because if definitions of race and racism don't include power and privilege, it's not a real definition, y'all. Like, it's not. The whole of, like, just not liking each other, that's not going to be it. Because the definition, I think, of racism in Webster's dictionary, it was, like, written in 1902. What was happening in 1902? Probably some problematic stuff, right? And I always ask people, is that really the definition you want to use from 1902 when there was Jim Crow and lynchings? Probably not. And also, if you look, Webster's is like, yo, don't use us to, you know, clarify argument. They say that, and they're like, we're not here. We're just telling you when this started showing up. So I want you to critically think more about your definitions and what they mean to you and where they've come from. Okay, so now I want you to think about yourself. And so when we talk about this, this is also important. This is just like kind of layers. You know, we've talked about passing. Now we're going to maybe get into some setting. Okay, we can't just talk about running a fast offense if we ain't started from a foundation, right? I can do this with volleyball people. Other people, they're like, what? So, yes. Okay, so these are the two things that like help us determine who we are. Okay, so our frames are our big pictures. Boy, girl, black, or white. People are pregnant. What do they really, really want to know if you're pregnant?
Boy or girl.
And what happens if you don't tell them? You get really mad and try and trick your friend who won't tell you. Not looking at you, Jen. She's pregnant, won't tell me. But we have this dualistic idea, right? We have to know if it's a boy or girl. Yes, it's going to be a healthy baby. I know that. But I still want to know. And that's our dualistic world. Black, white. Whenever babies come out of the womb for black people, they immediately check their nails or their ears to see how light or dark they're going to be. That's just a part of our world, right? Because we have to know how close to whiteness they're going to be. On the real? That's what we're looking for. And we look at our lenses, and this is what makes us who we are. We don't even realize it shapes us. Things like being an only child, outgoing. If you're blind, trans, LGBT, if you're a veteran, all these things shape your lenses. And we have to understand how our lenses affect our biases. So when I was younger, I'm the baby. I guess you could say I'm the only child. I'm the baby. And my mom's favorite. If you ask Carol Fry, I am her favorite. My Facebook friends know I'm Carol Fry's favorite. So when I was in high school, I was a senior in high school, and I was taking junior college classes. And at the junior college I ended up playing at, and for spring break, their spring break was a week before ours. So I asked my mom, can I go on the college spring break? What do you think she said? She was like, of course. So I get to go on this week-long college spring break. I did not tell my high school I wasn't showing up. I just didn't show up. I was on the track team. I just didn't tell my coach I was showing up either. So we went on a 7-car caravan. Oh, by the way, I'm from Arizona, right by the border. So we went to Mexico for a few days. We went to Vegas for a few days. I'm 17. We went to Lake Havasu. Do y'all remember like Lake Havasu, the grind? With the boats and, you know, all that. Like, hey, that's like the Lake Havasu of my time. Went there. And then I had the guts. So in Lake Havasu, there was a track meet. So what do? After missing a week of track practice, roll up to the track meet, ready to go. I'm surprised my coach didn't kill me. But my thought was always very free. So I can never understand what other people, I'm like, why don't you just go by yourself to this concert? I can't do that. Why not? My mom just really let me be like a feral cat. I just do whatever. She was like, you're alive, I'm good. But other people, their parents would never have let them do that type of stuff. And so you have to look at your lens. Is your lens is maybe someone that's an older child, and that's how you've been treated, versus a younger child? You have to think of that lens. And when you're recruiting, I could never understand why people didn't want to go away far from home. And now I get you want to be close to your family. But I have to understand my lens and what I'm looking at and how I've perceived the world when I'm talking to athletes. It's the same thing if you're extroverted or introverted. You have to think about that stuff, because if you're an introverted coach and you keep telling your athletes, you're too loud, you're too aggressive, what is that telling them? Especially if you only tell your black females that they're loud and aggressive. Because I'm going to tell you, that's what we're told all our life. So I want you to think about these lenses. If you're introverted, what are your interactions with outgoing people? And if you're outgoing, what are your interactions with introverted people? So I want you to think of those lenses, how you look at the world. Because regardless, that affects your interaction with your athletes. So you're going to pair and share again. I know you're so excited. So I want you to think of, what are some of the lenses that make you unique? You might be like, you know what? Just hypothetically, me and my sister both play volleyball at Florida. That might be a lens. And what does that mean? You know, what are some of the lenses that could affect your vision when working with student athletes? I was raised in a single family home. That affects some of my lenses when working with athletes that have maybe both parents. And I'm like, I acknowledge that. And so I want you to think about that. Some of the lenses you have, how that affect your vision. Okay. How can your lenses affect your student athletes? If you were raised in a big family, if you're raised by yourself, how can those lenses affect your student athletes? Because they do. And then lastly, what lenses affect your student athletes' vision of you? Because your athletes have lenses. When you recruit them, you talk all about those lenses. How they grew up, where they grew up, their family, their sisters and brothers, those are all their lenses. So I want you to think on a more critical level of how those lenses of those athletes you work with can affect the vision of you. Because it's going to make you think a little differently with those interactions. So find a new partner, okay, and you're going to talk about these questions for 5 minutes. Go. Don't be afraid. Be like, hey, friend. Okay, give a high five. I didn't put my slide, darn it. Okay, so now let me have three people kind of share out thinking about these kind of questions, especially interaction with student athletes. We get three groups, or three people. Eduardo, and then, yeah.
So both of us were, like, we feel like we've been really independent, and that can skew the way we work with student athletes, because like you were talking about, like, we don't understand, like, what do you mean you can't move far away from home? Like, we could, why can't you? So that's something that we got to really be conscious of.
Yeah, I travel the world all by myself all the time, and when people are like, I can't do that, I'm like, why? I just couldn't even imagine not doing that. But I have to think about my lens. Like I said, my mom raised me like a feral cat. I just do whatever. And so I have to remember that type of stuff, that that is not their lens, and be okay with that. And how can I then help them with my experience of going and helping them understand that they can do it by themselves? Did you?
We both talked about we were kind of similar in, like, we had to work for a lot of things. We were raised with a lot of money. So, like, working with student athletes, when they get a lot of things handed to them, it like, we have that lens of, you're just not working hard. Like, you don't know how to work hard.
Yeah.
But to them, like, how does that affect them? It makes them feel like we don't think they're hard workers.
Yeah.
You know? And that lens of, like, just from different backgrounds, and they're working as hard as they know how to.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think that's a great example of, like, this hard work that, you know, I'm coaching 18's team now. Oh, I haven't coached in a while. And bless my heart, not theirs, mine. And so, you know, one of the girls was like, I'm working hard. I'm like thinking to myself, you're working as hard as you think you are. We're going to get you working harder. But, like, that's that thought. It's like, this is what allowed me to succeed, this type of work ethic. And now you're coming to another level, and they just don't understand it. And it's like, oh, well, you don't think I work hard enough? But try and get them to that next level when you're used. I mean, I thought about, you know, I had jobs since I was 14. And then I would get athletes in that their parents didn't want them to work in school. And I'm like, y'all better get a job. But that they didn't want that. So that time management aspect, all those things you learn from working as a young age, they never had. And so what does that mean for my lens, who've always had a job, and their lens, who they've never had one? And what does that mean when they have to work camp for you, right? You're like, oh, she's never had a job. She's never had a job. Keep remember that. Okay, let me get one more person.
I was raised in a very traditional two-parent household, and all my friends, I think back growing up, I didn't have a single friend whose parents were divorced. And our team this year, probably over half of them had blended, non-traditional, a lot of them whose parents were in the middle of going through things. And so I found myself asking a lot of questions in a respectful manner of just, hey, help me understand, help sit in what you're sitting in, because I've never experienced it, and anybody else experienced this. And it was really, really eye-opening to me in that way of just what I, maybe my expectation of what it looks like and what it really looks like, and I have, you know, my lens and none of that in my experiences.
Yeah. Thank you. And I think that's a good point. Like, families are so different now. And if we don't have that experience, we just don't understand the problems that come with it. The cousins that are living with the grandma now, or the mom's away, all these things that we've never had a clue, and how it's really affecting our athletes. And be able to ask those questions and say, hey, help me understand so I can understand what you're going through. So now that I'm coaching, what I have my girls, because I miss a lot of practices, I'm not going to lie, and because I do a lot of speaking engagements, and I had them do a journal, and they journal for like 2 or 3 minutes after practice, and I just say, just journal whatever you want. If you're like, you know, this practice I didn't like because these reasons, or I hate you, cool, let's talk about it. Like, I want you to write these things. If you're having problems, and one girl was like, I'm just having some family problems. Thanks for letting me know. And giving them a space, because I will be gone so much, of communicating with me, so I can still kind of help them learn to advocate for themselves and talk about stuff with different emotions to help them be better women. So that's one of my biggest goals, but I always have to be paying attention to my lens. So thank you all for sharing. So now we're going to quickly go through this cycle of socialization. And so what this is literally how we are trained in society. And so what it is in the beginning, literally in the beginning, we know nothing. We're born, we know nothing. And then when we have our first socialization, this is how we're taught. We're taught by parents, teachers, brothers and sisters. What are some of the things you're taught from age 0 to 4? Just yell them out. Please and thank you. What else? Be kind. Huh?
Always wash your hands.
Say sorry.
To share.
So all these things, but think about how in different cultures they might be taught different things. And understand that this socialization is so different. Parents, how they, teachers, all that stuff. Even what age they go to school and what the teachers are teaching them. So this first socialization is so very different. And then we have the next one, which is institutional and cultural. And this is how we are bombarded with messages. This is how our implicit biases start to form. Okay, church or faith institutions. Tell me, what messages do you get from faith institutions? Let's hear it. Love one another. Now y'all go to faith institutions? Huh? Forgiveness? What else?
Prayers.
Huh? Praying, what else?
Acceptance.
My mom's a recovering Catholic, is what she says. So her definition, what she learned in church, was that she was a sinner.
A sinner?
Yeah.
Yep. All these bad things we learn. What are some of the stuff that we're not told, but we learn very quickly? Guilt. How we wear our hair, right? What's an appropriate length of clothing? You learn that real quick. What you should wear, what you should say, who to love, who not to love, who it's acceptable not to love. So those are messages we get in school. What are some of the things we learn in school? Y'all went to school, right?
Follow orders.
Follow orders. Speak a little bit more on that. How are you taught to follow orders?
Stand in line. Everybody sits at assigned desks. Come in every day. I think they're just custom.
Yep, exactly. What are some of the unwritten curriculum rules that you're taught then?
Raise your hand to speak.
And how are you taught that?
By being scolded if I don't.
What other things are we unknowingly taught? What's appropriate to say? Who it's appropriate to play with? Right? We're taught all these things that we don't even realize, that we have this unwritten curriculum that we've been taught unknowingly by teachers. Acceptance on what we wear, how we wear our hair. Oh, look at you. You're dressed all fancy today. Oh, what are you wearing today? Or, oh, look at you. You got your hair done. Don't you look pretty? Oh, your hair. Okay. Right? It's unwritten, but that's how we're being treated. That's what we're told. And that's how the kids are being told. On television, who's terrorist? Who's the bad guy? Who's the person who should always be saved? So these are things that we are always taught. If we look on social media, one of the things that we're always taught is to save disabled people. Always. Right? Look at you helping that person across the street. Even though they're like, stop pushing me. Look at you helping them. We're taught that we have to be a savior. There is a woman on Twitter that she said that she put spikes on her handles because people would grab her and just push her. Think about that. But we're taught in media to save people. And who are we all, who's always the person saving or who's the person being saved? And those are kind of things that create our biases. This bias that people that are disabled cannot do stuff by themselves. So I have to help them. And if they say, no, don't help me, but I feel so bad. When did it become about you? But we've been taught that somebody has to save us, that we have to save someone. If we don't, we're like, okay, you know, let me know if you help me, that we're a bad person. So we have to think about all these things that we kind of, we've just been socialized to think that create our biases. The mental health industry, medicine, the legal system. We can talk long about that if you want to. Song lyrics. All these things, media, pageant, thought, these just keep affecting us on unconscious and conscious levels. And then the enforcements. Okay? So we have these biases. We've been socialized. And so now we have that we're being rewarded, we're being punished. So if I raise my hand, good job, Jen. If I'm just like, the answer's five. Jen, stop doing that. So now, how's that enforcement happening? If someone keeps stepping out of line, and I'm like, Miss Karen, John keeps stepping out of line. Good job, Jen. Wait, say something. So how am I being rewarded, and how am I being punished? And we have to think about these type of things. Who's being persecuted? Who's getting power from it? Who's not? And then the results. These things are occurring from the socialization that happens within the U.S., within the world. Crime, patterns of power, silence, anger, guilt. All these things are occurring. And then at the end, we have these two options. Actions, that we do nothing, we don't make waves. We stay on that escalator that's moving, saying, I'm going to be silent. That's not me. I'm a good person. Because we have to remember two things. You can be a good person and still have work to do. And we always want to think that we are a good person. And so because of that, we're not that other person. You can be an All-American and still have work to do. You can be Coach of the Year. I don't know, maybe not Charlie Sullivan, who's like 15-time Coach of the Year. But other Coach of the Year, you can still have work to do. And so I want you to keep that kind of dichotomy in your mind. That you can be a good person and still have work to do. Because some of us get caught in the good person part because we're afraid that if we admit we have work to do, then we're a bad person. And so really making change, raising consciousness, interrupting, educating, taking a stand and saying, no, that's not appropriate. Be being that person that's willing to be that voice and step up. Because I want you to understand that how you were socialized affects your implicit biases. All those things that we talked about affect your implicit biases. So while we're talking about reducing workplace reducing workplace biases, what we're talking about is really you critically thinking about yourself to make change. Because that's the only way real change can happen. And here's some ways to reduce it. Look at the words used to describe student athletes: loud versus passionate, leader versus bossy. If you have a lot of black students and you're like, you cannot wear your hair bonnet, which is something that they wear at night, you can't wear it down for breakfast, but you allow white students to wear a bandana, what's that saying? So thinking about those type of things. What words do you use to describe your athletes? There's a great TED Talk that talks about the words that journalists use to describe, the black quarterback is athletic, is able to do all these things. The white quarterback is work ethic and strategic. And what are these words saying? So think about that in the articles your SIDs write. What do they mean and what are they saying to these athletes? Okay, how do you use the word aggressive? Many times it's used to stop women from doing stuff. You're being too aggressive. Versus other students, you are being aggressive, keep it up. So think about that, because that's going to help reduce bias. Your hiring practices. Your network, who are you asking about for applicants, and what is considered good experience? I was a head coach at a small historically black school. Many people are not going to think HBCUs are great experience. But let me tell you, we get like two dimes to rub together, and we do it. But people don't look at that stuff. It's like it has to be these names or these genres. They don't look at minority-serving institutions, HBCUs, which are historically black colleges and universities. That's not thought of as good experience. Junior college isn't thought of as good experience. High school. So, like, we have to rethink what do we think of as good experience and who are we disproportionately affecting if we say they only have to have X, Y, and Z. So that's a big thing. Check your assumptions about work ethic versus culture. Because we want to recruit a lot of international students, but we don't want to acknowledge that they have different work ethics and what it means. When I was at school, I had like three Brazilians. Brazilians take their time. And I didn't understand that. And I didn't talk to them about it. So I'm like, oh, they're just being lazy. No, that's just their culture. I just came from Cuba. They take their time. And I have to acknowledge, if I'm going to get players from XYZ, I have to talk to them about their culture and our expectations and be willing to work through it with them. Versus saying, oh, she was lazy, kick her off. Well, she was at, in Brazil putting 40 kills down, you liked that then. So really think about checking your biases of what work ethic means to you and who determined what's appropriate or not appropriate work ethic. Think about that. Who determined that? Policies, procedures, and handbooks, who do they center? If you say, you know what, everyone has to have the same color hair, why? Why can't you have a person with blue hair? What does it matter? Who are you affecting that you have these hair things that they can and can't wear? Because I was at a school and this coach was like, I just want to recruit someone with blue hair. And I'm like, why? Well, they don't have a work ethic, this and this. Why? Because they have blue hair? So think about your handbooks and who do they disproportionately affect. Have people that English is not their native language or first-gen people look through the handbooks. And if it's hard for them, that means you need to change it. Who's writing that handbook and who is determining if it's easy or hard? So I'll show you, there's a Harvard test on implicit bias. It's like 12 minutes long. Just take it. Super easy to do. And then what are the identities of the people you're bringing to speak to your team? Think about that. Who are you bringing in? Are you bringing in just a whole bunch of white speakers and you didn't try and take an extra step and be intentful and go find other people? So think about that. And then understand that you can love all your student athletes and still have problematic behavior that needs to be rectified. You can love them all, but still do problematic things and say problematic things. So one last high five to your person. Okay, so here, if you want to take a picture, here's a bunch of good implicit biasy websites. And if anyone wants, you can take my card. I'll shoot you this as well. Shoot you the PowerPoint so you have all that. And lastly, here's my contact information. I have pictures, I have cards and stickers with my face on them. If you want that, come up and grab one. And if you have any questions, let's chat. We got, a minute. Anyone have any questions? I'm not that good.
So I kind of know a little bit about it, but what made you really want to shift from coaching down the diversity and inclusion route? Like, what made it such a big passion for you that you would change from one to the other?
I was on a car ride with a former head coach, and she didn't want to listen to what I was saying. And I was like, if we keep talking, I'm going to lose my job. And I knew I wanted to talk about it. That literally was, and I was like, okay, we got 30 more minutes to drive. This is awkward. But I literally was like, we can't, I'll lose my job if we keep talking about it. And I knew I had to make that jump because I couldn't bring in athletes of color and she not advocate for them or help them. And that was going to be a big problematic issue. So I knew I had to take this jump because there was a group that wasn't being heard, and I wanted to help them be heard.
So, like in athletics, you know, you tend to hire people that are, you know, similar to you. How do we, you know, try to break that barrier and try to get more people, diverse people into these groups as far as not just coaches, but administration and athletics and, you know, SIDs, assistant ADs, all of that, you know, academic.
Yeah.
How do you suggest?
So I have a humble brag. I did a TED Talk. You look it up. It's on that like 85% of administrators are white. And it's who they're hiring their network. If their network isn't diverse, then they're not going to hire diverse candidates. So I think making it a point of if you're on a search committee asking, is this a diverse applicant pool? Because most people, you know, put their race. Is this a diverse? We got to get more diversity. Make some calls. You know, contact some people. Start building your network of, hey, we're looking for an assistant. Do you have a diverse candidate pool? And really start saying, like, we can't do interviews unless we have this diverse, you know, pool of people. And start, when you're hiring, ask people. So tell me about your experience of using cultural centers. How do you plan on recruiting a diverse set of student-athletes? How do you plan on recruiting diversity? Make them have to answer those questions. If they're not, don't hire them. Because you hire them and you're about diversity, well, they're not going to be. So you really making a stand on search committees and being the person in the room willing to raise your hand and have that conversation. I'll be here for like 10, 15 more minutes. Thank you all for coming. I appreciate it.